to volume control knob. It doesn't quite sound the same as any other knob you've ever used, because almost all the other knobs that you use are designed for an audio taper or a logarithmic taper.
That's very true, but a logarithmic taper or is used in an amplifier circuitry, which has various reactances associated with it, is where that comes in. But for a very simple, you turn it halfway and you get half the volume or half the voltage. Trust me on that one. Look it up. And that's why they have linear tapers and amplifiers, because of all the inductances, and why you have frequency response, different frequency response, because of the inductances. That's why that was done, but that's just amplifier theory, or whatever you want to call it, reactance theory.
Okay, but again, the problem is organic sensors are designed to compress dynamic range, and the way that they do it is to compress it on audio and visual. So that's why your eyes see in light intensities logarithmically as well. So that's why sound is measured in decibels, because they're logarithms. So that's the nature of station. So we're all logarithmic.
Anyways, I thoroughly understand the logarithmic response of the human ear. By the way, it's a base 10 log, as opposed to an E log. But anyways, to make your life simple, trust me, go voltage divider. Look it up. Enough said. Katie, this topic has been beaten to death. I think it's time for a new topic. Katie 2M, Z clear.
Okay, Rich, you got a bunch of options. Feel free to experiment. Come back at your leisure and tell us what you've discovered.
Will do, Roy. Thanks, W2BC.
Okay, very good. Next on our list tonight is Ken, WB2KWC. You have two things for tonight, so please.
Okay, first one is ham radio related. The other day I noticed that the output power of my HF radio was unusually low. Looking around for the source of the problem, I discovered that the voltage output of my power supply was down to about 11 volts. I must have accidentally hit the output voltage adjustment, which is sitting on the front panel. When I turned up the power supply voltage, the output power of the radio returned to normal. So, I'm just curious, what voltage should I set my power supply to? Looking it up, the maximum voltage accepted by the radio is 13.8 volts. I leave the power supply voltage set to 13.6, and the RF output of the radio seems normal. So I guess my questions are, what is the ideal voltage of the power supply? What are the symptoms and dangers of too high a voltage and too low a voltage?
Yes, WB2KW3. AC2GS, well, that's a good question, Ken. Ultimately, the most waffly answer is it sort of depends upon the particular box that you're operating. That's a kind of a bad answer because it's both obvious and doesn't tell you anything. Almost every single radio that's designed to operate in the, I'll say, the 12-volt range, is in fact, tends to be designed for 13.8. Almost every time that you look up to see what is the preferable voltage, you will get 13.8. It, again, depends upon the design what happens if you go above or below that. Different things happen to different circuit designs. As you notice, the amplification circuits fail. In some cases, that's very common. Others, not so much. In some cases, what happens is you'll get to a certain voltage where the microprocessor will be very unhappy with you and will reboot your radio. So it is not unusual for people who have regulatory problems. Their power supply isn't capable of running the proper power, and what happens is their regulation fails and their voltage drops. And they'll say, you know, I transmit, and as soon as I transmit, the radio resets itself. Let me just stop to read another entry from John, KD2BD. Too high can cause damage. Too low will increase transmitter IMD. Adjust the power supply so that the recommended operating voltage is seen at the transceiver, which is an important point that I was going to make a little bit later on. So if you run too low, different circuits will fail depending upon their design. And ultimately, if you have a radio that uses a microprocessor, it will just reboot completely. As you go up, again, depending upon the radio, there are some radios that will detect a dangerously high voltage and shut things down. Others won't, and it is theoretically possible to burn out your radio if you do something silly like put in a 24-volt DC input to it. What John mentioned was that just because your power supply is putting out 13.8 volts does not necessarily mean that your radio is receiving 13.8 volts. It depends upon the gauge of your wires and the length of your wires. Over time, there is a nominal resistance in your power lines that will cause the voltage to drop. Now, there tends to be, in my experience, a lot of
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Oops, I timed it out. Let me just repeat the very last thing that I mentioned, and hopefully that's the only thing that got clipped. It's that John mentioned that it has to do with the voltage at the transceiver, because the power line is going to have some nominal resistance and have some resistance loss. So by the time it snakes around and gets to your transceiver, that 13.8 will be a little bit lower than that. So I run mine hot at 14.6. I do that because my lithium iron phosphate charging circuits need something a little more oomph than 13.8. I haven't had a problem with it for years. Did you hear that, Ken?
Yes, I did. I thank you, and I thank John.
Okay, very good. Was there another part of your statement question thing? You said you had one that was amateur radio related and one that isn't. Unless there's someone out there who wants to have any kind of opinion on what I said and what I read from John. Okay, so no reply. So, Ken, what's your non-amateur radio-related question?
Okay. We haven't had a COVID question all evening, so I thought I'd ask one. When we first encountered COVID, hearing that somebody had the disease was of great concern. Essentially, you were worried that they were going to die. Now, when somebody has COVID, it seems to be more of an inconvenience. They will isolate from 5 to 14 days and test again. And basically, once they test negative, they resume normal human contact. So I'm curious: have we become immune? Has COVID become less dangerous, or are people simply weary of COVID news?
AC2GS. Oh, again, a terrible answer would be all of the above, but let me break it down. What is very often the story for most epidemics, what have you, is that as the viruses mutate through the population, if given the opportunity, they will usually tend to adjust on a couple of parameters. They will attempt to be as infectious as possible, which is the case with the present Omicron variant, and it will tend to be less lethal. And again, it's for sort of the same reason. The ultimate feedback mechanism for a virus is to spread as much as possible. And the way that you do it is twofold. You want to be highly infectious and give out lots and lots of viral particles to spread that infection. But you don't want to kill the person carrying your infection too soon, because that kind of terminates the transfer and also scares the things that you're infecting to stay away from these dying people, these dying creatures. So that's generally it with viruses. You saw the same thing with the great influenza pandemic of 1918, where we still have the variants of H2N2, which killed all those people back in 1918 to 1920. But it has mutated to be somewhat more infectious, but less deadly. It's still good to take a vaccine. It still kills way too many, especially elderly or chronically ill people, but yeah, that's it. Now, that's not to say that the variant is gone. The infectious rate is still high. Yesterday, I think we have 85,000 plus new cases of COVID, and we have 335 deaths. So a lot of people are getting it. Not that many people are dying, but some people are still dying. And to a degree, it's just people are fatigued, they're tired. And we all have this weird thing being human beings. We get used to all kinds of things. Let me drop for a second so I don't time out. Okay, we get used to things. So, you know, people in the middle of World War II sort of got used to it despite the fact that it was a terrible calamity. So it's a combination of all those things. The coronavirus is still around. It's still infecting a lot of people. It's more infectious than it was in the past. It's less lethal than it was in the past. There's no guarantee that there's going to be some new mutation variant that will change those figures in some way, in shape and form. My guess is that from the rumors I hear, come September or October, there'll be a push for a Omicron variant tweak vaccination that they'll be giving everyone for free and urging everyone to take. It'll be interesting to see what percentage of people take that. But that's as far as I can see of what's going on in COVID right now.
Okay, thank you. So basically, I guess it's in the virus's, quote, best interest, if you will, not to be too fatal, because it would kill off all the hosts.
I mean, I guess a perfect virus would be one that's asymptomatic, but you shed viral particles and you do it for your entire lifetime. So that would be a dream come true for any kind of virus reproducing, because, you know, if that was the case, everyone would have it. You know, like almost everyone has gotten infected with herpes, you know, cold sores and such. So that's kind of an example of really a virus that did very well for itself.
Are you trying to say that viruses have some kind of artificial intelligence?
No, not in the slightest. They are not conscious. They do not have any intelligence. But it's just a looping mechanism. You have a device that the way to expand its existence, the number of its particles, is to have certain properties, and you have sites on its RNA that are variable. So if you give it a lot of people to crank out every possible mutation, you inevitably, by feedback mechanism of reproduction, fitness, it's old Darwin in action, survival of the fittest, just by the fact that they're able to reproduce more effectively means that there are larger and larger population groups. So it's not a conscious effort. It's just a self-organizing complex system. It kind of explains why you don't need a designer to build life. If you give life a couple of billion years and the proper chemistry, inevitably it'll find an interesting way to utilize thermodynamics.
BDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
To get back to his original question, though, why it doesn't seem like a death sentence now, I think when people spoke of it as a death sentence, we didn't have any working vaccine. Now we have a functional vaccine as well as some other things that are very effective. So it is no longer a death sentence. Like it originally was back in the early part of 2020.
Well, yes, you're quite right. Unfortunately, the vaccine was designed for the original virus, and as it has mutated repeatedly, the efficacy, we talked about efficacy of viruses, of vaccines, I think it was suggested that somewhere between 92 and 95%, which is fantastic, which is great. I think the Chinese vaccine had a far lower efficacy in the 70 percentile. The problem, though, is with each mutation, that efficacy kind of dropped. At this point, the efficacy for not becoming infected is now maybe 20% on a good day. But it's surmised, and it's difficult to kind of tweeze out the details, that although not getting infected isn't that great with people who took the vaccine, the degree of how sick you got might have been lessened. So there might be a decrease in mortality due to the vaccination, or it might be more likely due to just the mutation shifting from a more dangerous version to one that you can survive to spread this virus farther. So it's difficult to kind of say between the two. Also, I want to address a death sentence. It really wasn't quite a death sentence, thankfully. Its mortality rate was approximately 1%. Now, if you were part of that 1%, you know, that's dangerous, that's terrible, that's awful. But 99% of people infected did not die. Now, that isn't to say that a lot of them will suffer long-term problems. That is yet to be fully understood. But although it was incredibly dangerous, I wouldn't exactly categorize it, even at its worst, as a death sentence. It was risky, but, you know, a lot of people caught it early and survived. Just 1% didn't. So, that's a terrible number. There were people who said, only 1% of our population will die. Let's all just jump in and get it. It's just a terrible idea.
Well, it was also the thing, too, if you remember, we had those trucks and vans lined up outside of hospitals that were just holding bodies. So the perception was that it was probably a lot worse than it was. So that might have had something to do with it.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul recognized. Just want to put in my 2 cents. Well, I mean, the problem is that hospitals are designed for a particular death rate. And when the death rate kind of doubles or triples, and, you know, you don't need that many deaths. If the number of people in New York City were infected were say, 500,000, say, and 1% die, that's 5,000. That's probably more than enough to clog every autopsy and facility in the city. So, again, it was scary, and there were people denying it. I remember one person said that she passed by a hospital and didn't see the ICE truck. They were there. It doesn't really require much because hospitals lately are kind of designed to be efficient. So they don't have a lot of empty space. They're kind of designed to be operated at the rate that they generally need to. So they're not very flexible that way. And that's a problem with healthcare and the cost of healthcare. Any other comments, questions, answers?
K2SCP.
Yeah, NWS2N.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, Paul. So, Paul recognized, Chris recognized, Paul goes first, and Chris.
Okay, so I'm just wondering what happened to the first one.
I believe they call that Alpha. For that matter, there's the Delta. I mean, has that been eradicated from the first face of the Earth, or is it traveling around, maybe still in, you know, some obscure country? Are they gone? Is Delta gone? I mean, there must be a record of, like, the last person that got Delta or something. Back to you, Roy.
Well, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's far easier to just test if you're infected, if you're shedding viruses, than the exact genetic type. In the old days, it would be practically impossible. Genetic typing was an arduous thing. Back 20 years ago, they had the Human Genome Project that they thought might take 20, 30 years to accomplish, but they improved the technology. So they do testing, and it seems the overwhelming majority, as far as I'm aware, are just variants of Omicron right now in the United States. Now, unfortunately, I haven't seen any good studies that go all over the entire world. My guess, knowing how viruses work and how human beings work, is there are probably pockets of both the older variants and variants that never really escape a local area, that hopefully won't ever. So you can never be quite sure, but the overwhelming reports that I've seen are just different variants, BA4, BA2, different variants of the Omicron. What happens for the most part is just the Omicron outbred all the other variants. It was just so much more effective that it kind of glommed on to any possible food source, being human beings, and just kind of starved the older variants into maybe little micro pockets hidden off in weird little out-of-the-place areas of the Earth. You know, unfortunately, it's sort of the same thing going on with polio. We thought polio was dead, but obviously there were little pockets of polio someplace, and they popped up. Same thing with monkeypox. Monkeypox is not endemic, but it is regularly seen in Africa. It would be nice if we had a whole stockpile of smallpox vaccine that we produced for 9/11, and it was going to expire. It has already expired. You know, if it was close to expiration, it would probably have been nice of us to give it to the countries in Africa that have active monkeypox problems to kind of lessen the risk of us getting the monkeypox, but I guess we decided not to. Paul, any response?
Oh, no. Okay, very good. Thanks for that. And you mentioned testing, and of course, you can still get free tests. You can still send away for them. They'll only send you a certain amount, and then eventually they know from you, I guess, your IP address that you've reached your limit. But if you want to get a couple of extra ones, some libraries, in fact, my library had it, where I could walk into the library and they had like a big bowl of tests for you know, antigen tests. You know, you take one box and there's two tests in each one. And, you know, they would say, you know, everybody take one box and you're good to go. Some libraries do have it. I know I have a relative upstate and they have it in theirs, but, you know, upstate New York. And I had it here. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, thankfully, they're in big supply and the places are just giving them away. I think someone told me that they went to a drugstore and they were just handing them out for free as well. So, yeah, the government has subsidized millions and millions and millions of these tests. I mean, we don't use them anywhere as much as the Chinese have gone kind of crazy with their zero COVID policy, where they'll shut down major areas of the city and require all their citizens to stand online, probably creating a bigger risk for infection, to wait to be swabbed. And, you know, it's Brave New World time. They have a cell phone that has a QR code. If you're annoying them or if you get a positive test result, your QR code changes from green to red, and you're basically locked up in your home until they pick you up and put you to a quarantine center. So It's a scary place in China these days due to the zero COVID policy.
WB2KW3.
Yes, Ken?
Okay, I have received a number of the free COVID tests. Just one thing, when you get the test, check on it. You may discover that it has already expired. And are there any guidelines of how long after a COVID test has expired that it is still usable and you can rely on the results?
Usually the expiration dates are very, very conservative. So theoretically, probably a month later isn't going to affect it one way or the other. But because they are so ubiquitous out there and generally free, my suggestion for the general public, unless it's very inconvenient, is if it's listed as expired, throw it away and get some new shiny ones. Just to double, be absolutely sure. Because you don't fundamentally know how they were stored. If they were stored inappropriately before you got them, it can pre-age them so that even though their expiration date isn't that far off, you never quite know what the intermediates were. So in this particular situation, I would say, get tests that aren't expired. That's your safest approach.
K2, SCP.
Yes, Chris. Yes, Chris, what do you have to say today?
Hi, thanks, Roy. Just a quick couple of things. First, I'm not crazy with COVID, one of the crazy paranoid types. However, I can tell you it is still out there and very prevalent. 3 weeks ago, a friend of mine contracted it, 58 years old, and 2 weeks later, he passed away. He was at Stony Brook. So it is out there, still careful. Second thing is, it is a lot more prevalent than being reported because of the home test. The people doing the home test are not reporting it anywhere. So, the numbers that you read are probably one-tenth of what's really out there. It's a lot more out there than what's being reported. I'm sure you understand that, Roy. Sorry, dropped it there. The other thing is CVS, you can drive up to CVS for a free test. They've been always giving out free tests instead of doing it at home. There's a test out there. But like I said, the people doing home tests are not reporting it. It's just disappearing, those cases.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. And unfortunately, I've never totally believed the numbers anyway. I tend to think that it's been underreported for a whole bunch of different reasons, to different degrees. Different states tend to do strange things, and you can sort of see, on the weekends they don't report anything, and then on the next weekday, you kind of expect something in line with the previous days of reported, but it's not. So, there are some wacky things in some states and some countries, completely insane things. I think North Korea announced that they were now free of COVID, and they had something like 25 or 45 total deaths in the country. So I think the glorious leader there just pulled that number out of his glorious backside. You got to take these things all with a grain of salt. It's going to be very messy trying to reverse engineer how many people became infected, because it's not something as simple as taking serology tests, because you have all the people who were vaccinated who are going to have lots of serologies. So it's one of those things that are going to be argued for another 100 or 200 years of what the real numbers throughout the world were, how many people died, how many people caught the virus once, twice, or thrice.
And I also believe
not only did the virus kind of burn itself out, as you mentioned, you know, morphed into something less deadly, I think the people that were susceptible to dying from it, a lot of them unfortunately have already passed. So I think that might affect some of those death numbers as well. K2SCP.
Well, I mean, that's always iffy because it's possible. But the point is that you could probably just analyze the death rate of first infection. And so, you know, the people with the same genetic predisposition, if it was solely just the fact that, that you know, the people who were sensitive would have become infected earlier, the infectiousness does probably correlate with that. So my guess would be ultimately that there's the same percentage of high-risk people who've never been infected because they isolated themselves more effectively. But I have absolutely no numbers to prove any of that. Any other questions or comments on this particular subject? Otherwise, we'll move on to Jeff AB2MB. Okay, Jeff, you're up.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Boy, a great net tonight. Been enjoying all the discussions. Yeah, as you know, and you mentioned tonight, which I always appreciate, that I do an antenna net on Friday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific time. But I'd like to mention that actually every week we have the antenna of the week, and we started off with an antenna that's out there, and, you know, whether it's a vertical or, you know, a slot antenna, you usually pick one antenna and just kind of talk about it and go over it. And so I was wondering if anybody here has any antennas that they would like to, that they find really interesting and that we should discuss on the antenna net. So I thought I'd put that out there, Roy, AB6MB.
Okay, that's an excellent idea. Grist for the mill, again. Jeff has a great technical net. It focuses on antenna, so it's called the Papa System Antenna Technical Net. And Eastern Time it's 10 o'clock, Pacific it's 7. There are multiple ways of getting into the Papa network. You just Google it. So what he's asking for out there are interesting antenna designs that he could use as focus of his antenna of the week discussion. So anyone out there who has a favorite, slightly atypical, I guess, antenna, because I'm sure dipoles have been mentioned to death. So anyone out there with any good ideas for Jeff?
USDP.
Yes, Chris. Yes, Chris, what would you like to say?
The types that I would love to hear about. In fact, I will join that net. The first one is one I've kind of read about a while back and have been very interested in for some reason, and I did build one. It's called a barber pole, and I've mentioned it on here before. So it's, you take a PVC pipe, let's say a 2-inch pipe, and you wrap around a 1-inch wide copper tape around it, kind of looking like a barber post outside of the old barber shop. So you can get maybe 60% shorter antenna and get the same resonance out of it. I want to learn more about how it works or how it doesn't work. The second one, let me drop it for a second. A second antenna type that I'm interested in learning something about, and I also bought this one a while back and have been thinking about bringing it up again, and that is trying to make a very short antenna with the flat of material. So say, for example, a copper sheet, and you bend it into a spherical circle. So instead of a 10-foot high VHF antenna, you get maybe a 5-inch one, but it would be 10 inches round. But I know at some point you start to get capacitive and have other issues.
I'd like to learn what the values of those are.
CQSDBs.
Okay, that's very experimental. I mean, you're sort of describing a guy's design for a mobile that was brought up a few years ago. I think he calls it a compact antenna. It is basically it's sheet metal that's kind of wound, insulated and wound around itself and enclosed in a small plastic tube container. I'm sure you've seen it before, compact antenna. You should look it up.
Yeah, actually, I have seen that on YouTube, a guy explaining how they work. But I have the idea of taking that device, putting a small motor in it, and you roll it up so you get it tighter for certain bands, and then you loosen it to get wider. I don't know if that would work or what, but I just had this kind of dumb idea in my head, and I've always wanted to learn more about it.
Well, it would still be the same actual length. You would just be screwed around with capacitive coupling, and you know, that'll have some kind of a weird effect. But you know, that's vaguely reminiscent of stepper IRs that we mentioned a few months back, which was to be a fascinating design. What they do is they mechanically change the length of their yagis and dipoles and what have you. They have a spool of wire that shortens itself that's set on a servo, and if you want to attune to a lower frequency, what it does is it unspools and physically lengthens the radiators. So that would actually give you a difference in length. If you're just tightening and loosening a wound kind of watch spring type of device, you would need to insulate it, otherwise it would short itself out, and then you would have to deal with the capacitive interactions and couplings of the different segments.
Right, I got understood. I'm not explaining it perfectly well, so I'm thinking of making a cylinder out of this sheet metal, and then by winding it up, you're making a tighter, so maybe it starts off as the size of a can, and then when you loosen it, it's maybe 5 feet round instead of 2 feet round, but the height doesn't change. So I would like to see what effects those have. I know it would change the bandwidth. I don't know what else, but anyway.
Okay, I mean, AC2GS, by the way, that sounds interesting, and it sounds like it would be a hell of a problem to do a antenna simulation of something like that. So effectively, it's a loop antenna that's a variable circumference. Depending upon how you want it to use it, either as a magnetic loop, which would mean it's shortened, or a full wave loop, it would have different characteristics.
Exactly. So I'd love some people that actually know what they're talking about, as opposed to myself, to describe how this would work, what things would affect it. That would be fantastic.
Okay, yeah, that might be grist for the mill, a wee bit theoretical, but what have you. To Jeff, I haven't made a list of what your antennas of the week were, so I might be just kind of reproducing. Have you ever touched on either a bazooka type of antennas or double bazooka type of antennas?
Yeah, we touched on that, but back that. Like one of the things that we touched upon was that the thicker piece of wire has more bandwidth than the thinner piece of wire. And we talked about that. We talked about bazooka antennas, you know, with the cage-like configuration as you go down. Yeah, we touched upon those a bit. But I'm trying to think, does that answer your question, Roy?
Yeah, it does. Did you touch also, because cage dipoles are very similar in operation. Was that mentioned?
Yeah, we mentioned it on the net. Talked about it. Because I think we've had a question, somebody asking how to add bandwidth to an antenna, so we went that direction one night. I remember we were talking about that.
Okay, very good. Anyone else out there with any antenna types that that you think would be interesting to kind of deconstruct and discuss and use as a kind of a antenna of the week entry?
That's true.
I'm not quite sure if you meant to transmit, but you didn't ID yourself. Would you like to ID yourself? I guess he just stepped on the push-to-talk pedal. Once again, this is AC2JS. This is Limewalk Technical Net. We're talking with Jeff, AB2MB, net control operator for the Papa Network antenna technical net every Friday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you have a favorite antenna design, feel free to mention it, and hopefully Jeff will be able to use it as an antenna of the week. Another thing, you talked about so many different antennas, and I've never kind of written anything down. Did you ever touch upon the terminated folded dipole design? That's somewhat interesting. You probably have, but just in case you haven't.
No, we actually have not. I think we talked about terminated antennas, but never anything really specific. But a terminated folded dipole, I could definitely bring that up. In fact, that'd be a good one for next week because I'm interested in it. But I've seen them, but we have not discussed them as far as in depth like that. EB6MB.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I find the whole concept of traveling wave antennas fascinating, partially because amateur radio operators are very infrequently exposed to them. Most of our culture are traveling, standing wave. We always talk about resonating our antennas. We do not resonate, per se, a terminated traveling wave type of antenna, but most people, if you want to give them an example of a traveling wave, beverage is probably the best, but there's a few others that are used by amateur radio operators. So it's a fascinating group of antennas, and the terminated folded dipole was brought up here a couple of months ago, which is a very interesting design. So I hope the gang there on the West Coast enjoys that. Anyone else out there with any suggestions for any types of antennas that might do well with a technical net that is focused on antennas?
Of BBH with a comment.
Yes, John.
But what comes to mind is a log periodic antenna, but I suspect you might have discussed that already. Right?
Yeah, I think you did do log periodic. I might be wrong, Jeff, but did you?
Yeah, we discussed it in the last few weeks because I actually learned how they worked up until that point. I wasn't sure exactly, you know, how they did work, you know, and then my counterpart, Phil, K6UJO, talked about how they worked on there. Interesting, Arnett, what I tell everybody, I give the simple answer, then Phil, K6UJO, gives you the complicated answer. That's kind of how we work at AB6MB.
Yeah, it makes for a very engaging presentation. I would suggest that you all look for the Papa Network and check it out in future Fridays. Well, you've done magnetic loops. You've obviously done Yagis up, down, and sideways. You've done quarter-wave vertical ground planes. Have you done things like, you've mentioned collinear. That's kind of a given. The problem is that you've done so many different antenna designs, it's kind of difficult to come out. I mean, you did get somewhat esoteric with slot antennas. Again, something that fascinates the hell out of me. I've never actually seen a working slot antenna except in an article.
That night that we did slot antennas, that caught a lot of people by surprise. A lot of people had not even heard of them. And so that actually went over really well. And Phil and I dug into them. And, yeah, they're really interesting antennas because you can take a satellite dish, cut a slot in it, in the middle of it, not on the edge, and then you could actually use that as a 2 meter or 440 antenna. And you could be able to put up a 2 meter 440 where maybe they say you can't do it, but if the antenna itself is a satellite dish, then they can't stop you. So that people kind of like that idea, AB6MB.
Yeah, I mean, the whole approach is fascinating to me. It's sort of like a negative antenna. It's an antenna where its regions are zero space. You know, they're an absence of conductor. So that I was kind of amazed that you did that, because that's really on the edge of esoteric. Talking about esoteric, what about the relatively simple but microwave types of antennas, like patch antennas? Have you and Phil covered how cell phones and such work and how patch antennas work?
WS2N on the spotter antenna.
Yeah, sure. Paul, you want to say something?
Okay, I doubled before. Yeah, the first time I saw it was to drive through these campsites, and a lot of these campers have spotted antennas sticking out, you know, for television reception. You know, you look at it, and you say, what the heck is this? Each one has got, like, this spotted section in it, and these plates. And then I realized that that's a common thing among campers. You know, you draw these vacuum.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I was totally unaware of it. I knew of it as a variety of antenna. I did not know that it was used in that manner. That's interesting. Anyway, back to you, Jeff, regarding have you done anything about patch antennas or the type of antenna technology being used on things like cell phones?
No, we have not, actually. We have not discussed that at all. As soon as you mentioned it, I went, there's one we can use. Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up, because actually we had not discussed that.
Okay, very good. I mean, hams do use microwaves, and patch antennas are utilized for that. So it's a little bit more narrow than most of the antenna designs, but, you know, it might interest people how you cram the appropriate antenna into their iPhone. Perhaps a lot of hams don't bother with the details, so they just assume it sort of works. So that's another thing that you might bring up with Phil.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'm going to talk to Phil about that and probably do it this Friday. Because, you know, there is some microwave, you know, done in amateur radio. So I saw a guy was making a microwave antenna out of looked like a cookie tin in that. And I said, I've never seen one like that before. Back to you, AB6M.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who made antennas out of those Pringle cans. Most of them, usually when I saw them, they weren't really designed primarily for high microwave. They were more designed for Wi-Fi type of antennas. So, yeah, you might get into Wi-Fi antenna design, the beamforming that they do, which unfortunately hasn't really been utilized in amateur radio. Because the frequencies we use would require more significant mechanical manipulation. But, it's certainly something that probably people would find interesting, how their Wi-Fis are able to adjust the reception beam and change its radiation pattern to suit different environments and different number of users spatially.
Yeah, and that's interesting. You don't think about antennas and cell phones, you know, and actually I have never given it much thought. I think I read something a long time ago about antennas for cell phones, but I can't remember how they did it. But that would be very interesting to talk about. I'm going to give him a call after that and say, hey, what about this? especially the Patchington, which I've seen those people put up. I think, like somebody else said TV antennas, but I think they use patch antennas for TVs too, if I remember right, AB670.
Okay, most of the utilization that I've seen were for some microwave portion of the spectrum. So once again, this is AC2GS with the Limar Technical Net, and we're kind of asking people if they have any favorite antenna designs that are a little bit esoteric that could serve the purpose of a technical net's antenna of the week. So I'm sure there are a lot of people out there with interesting, slightly unusual antenna designs that they've either had experience with or they've heard the tales told. So please, if you do, suggest them to Jeff here.
KD2VHD, Jim.
Yes, Jim.
You happen to be on one of my favorite topics, but my technical knowledge is not nearly as good as my mechanical aptitude. Right now I'm talking to you on a Edfong DBJ1 antenna that's been modified to work so that it doesn't go into its sleeve of PVC with an SO239 at the bottom of the cap, but it hangs in the pipe from the top, so that I can stick it on various things and have the cable run down through the pipe. It's great for field use. It's great for low-profile applications, kind of like that might fit the guy we were talking about earlier with the parent problem. And I'm getting great use out of it. I think there's something to be said for it. It catches almost no wind because there's no cable taped to the side of the mast. It's almost invisible. It's a nice setup. It's not a new type of antenna. It's just slightly new mechanical setup. I figured I'd throw it out there. KD2VHD.
Okay, Jim, but what kind of configuration is it? I don't have a good sense. Is it a dipole? Is it a monopole? You know, I don't know kind of what to make of it right now.
Okay, the Edfong is a J-pole antenna made out of twin lead. They make two versions. One's a roll-up meant to be portable. The other one is a one to be set up as a base station. And I've kind of made a hybrid of it that's meant to be used as kind of a field, like a field day setup or a temporary setup or a low-profile setup. Slight variation mechanically with the connector and the way it's hung, but it's just a wire J-pole.
Okay, very good. Yes, I know J-poles. They're half-wave verticals usually, but you could arrange them horizontally, and they have a impedance-matching sub that's a quarter wavelength long that you adjust it for impedance of 50 ohms. I'm sure Jeff did J-poles in a bunch of different ways. Did you do J-poles? How many times, I should ask, have you done J-poles on your antenna net?
We did one night of J-poles. You pretty much stick to one subject. Of course, questions about J-poles comes up every once in a while, and we answer those questions. But yeah, we're really interested in the Edfong antenna because it's basically a modified J-pole, and it's pretty interesting. It's been quite an addition to the ham community, AV6MB.
Okay, very good. A lot of people love J-poles. There are people who hate J-poles. Some people think that they are too lossy and inefficient, and others swear by them. Others are into little variants, Jimmy Sticks or some such thing, where the takeoff angle is a bit high, a bit lower, I think. So it's more sensitive to low elevation hanging than a proper J-pole. So anyone else out there with any other novel antennas that they would like to share with us, and we can share with Jeff and his listenership over on the West Coast, and curious people across the country who get in through different gateways? Hello, Sam. How are you today?
Okay, I have a question for you. I know you probably know. I was looking at this dipole antenna that was 2 ham-6 into the main connection. They laid it out like a beam. Then on the YouTube, they came out with one that's a coil, like 4 feet of oil wire with an end sticking out and the beam. What is the coil one name?
Okay. Basically, they're building a shortened dipole. In order for dipoles to work, they have to be electronically resonant. So if they were mechanically resonant, they would have to be approximately one half wavelength in length. It's actually a little shorter because there's something called an edge effect, but nevertheless, a lot of people don't have the room, so they shrink down the dipole. If you shrink down the dipole, it is no longer mechanically resonant. A resonant antenna should read capacitance or inductance, only resistance. When you shorten it, it develops something called capacitive reactance, which you don't like and don't want. So you have an inductor that cancels that. You put the inductors on each shortened length to electronically lengthen the antenna so it is now resonant and able to radiate. So all these things are shortened verticals where the short length is made up with the inclusion of coils, which are known as inductors.
Roughly how many dBs do they put out? Is it a quarter wave or halfway?
Each of the leg is a quarter wavelength electronically. Mechanically, it's much shorter because that people don't have the area to extend it. So they're less than either. It sort of depends. You can theoretically build something called the infinitesimal dipole. Dick used to regularly discuss it. So you could have, 2 feet of actual wire, a very big coil to compensate for all the capacitive reactance that creates, and it will resonate. It won't be very efficient. A lot of the energy will end up waste heat energy, but you can get theoretically a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, and it'll say that it's transmitting, although it'll kind of heat up the area.
Thank you, Roy. And the other gentleman is really a glass. I'd like to see it on the promise. Roy, thank you. I always ask questions when I'm trying to build a station, right? And then when I get to the radio, my radio, I want to get the best stuff one time. I don't want to keep buying stuff. So that's why each week I ask you something about something different. Thank you so much.
Hey, C2GS, you're always welcome here, Sam. And any question you have, I'd be more than happy to help you with. And so will all the other people listening in. So be well, Sam, and I wish you all the luck with your new shack, and I'm sure it'll be a real nice one.
Thank you, Roy.
Okay, one last time, let's give it a try. Is there anyone out there with any kind of interesting type of antenna that's a little bit less obvious that Jeff could use as the antenna of the week on his weekly antenna technical net on the Papa Network on Friday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time? Oh, well, Jeff, I guess that's all for tonight, but you're certainly welcome to ask the question some other Sunday night. Not all the people who listen to the technical net are in a position to respond every Sunday night. So, you might get different answers another Sunday night. So you're always welcome here, of course, and you can ask the same exact question of the audience.
Okay, Roy, thank you very much. And if people are interested in finding out how to get to the antenna net, go to my QRZ page at It's Alpha Bravo 6 Mike Bravo, AB 6 MB. And I have essentially a list of the poppin' nets on there and how to get them. The reason we are multi-mode, so you can get to us via P25.